Hey, it's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, a cook shares his travels around Mexico in search of great recipes for his new cookbook. First, more than 3/4 of adults in the U.S. say they've experienced extreme weather in the last 5 years, like floods, wildfires, hurricanes, and heat waves. That's according to a survey by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. In just a bit, we'll find out how you and your family can stay safe when extreme weather strikes. Now we'll take a look at the connection between a changing climate and the risk of extreme weather events. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed storms or droughts or heat waves getting worse over the course of years? How worried are you about severe weather? What questions do you have for our guest about the connection between climate change and extreme weather events? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Michael Mann is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University. He's the author of the book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. It's available as a paperback with an update to the story. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Are we seeing more extreme weather events of various sorts in recent years?
There's no question. Here in the United States, elsewhere around the Northern Hemisphere, Europe, Asia, in the Southern Hemisphere, Australia, New Zealand, everywhere you look, we're seeing the impacts of climate change now play out in the form of these unprecedented weather extremes. And at some level, the connection is pretty basic. You make the planet warmer, you're going to get more episodes of extreme warmth, more frequent and more intense heat waves. You make the atmosphere warmer, it can hold more moisture. So when it does rain, you get more of it. You get more flooding. But at the same time, that heat dries out soils in the summer in particular, and so you get worse droughts as well. It's not rocket science. You know, there are some basic connections that tell us that this increase that we're seeing in these extreme events, these extreme weather events, is being driven by the warming of the planet, which we know in turn is being driven by our continued burning of fossil fuels and the increase in carbon pollution in the atmosphere.
I know it can be difficult to connect the dots between a particular extreme weather event. If it gets into the 90s for a couple days in Wisconsin, that could just happen by chance. It could be connected to climate change. Can you talk about how, even if you can't make that direct connection, the dice are kind of loaded?
Yeah, and the connection, and there's a whole science now that's been developed over the past couple decades, which is known as detection and attribution. You can basically use a climate model, for example, to look at a counterfactual scenario, say, where we didn't warm up the planet with carbon pollution, and a scenario where we did. And you can look in the simulations, you can look at particular types of weather events that happen in the course of the simulations, and you can tally them. How often does this sort of event happen in the counterfactual climate where we didn't warm up the planet? And how often does it happen in the actual climate simulation where we include the effect of carbon pollution? And when you see that a particular event was extremely unlikely to happen in the counterfactual scenario, but in fact happens regularly in the global warming scenario, then you can draw that connection. You can attribute the event in the same sense that we, for example, attribute deaths from cancer to from lung cancer, for example, to smoking. You know, we can't prove that any particular cigarette led to, you know, a case of lung cancer. But when we see that the increase in the prevalence of lung cancer is a factor of 100 or a factor of 1,000, it's such a large increase in the likelihood that we're comfortable in making that connection. We're comfortable in saying that, yes, somebody who smoked their whole life and died of lung cancer, they probably died from the smoking. We can make that same sort of statistical connection now with these extreme weather events. And one last point here, if anything, those attribution studies are conservative. In my view, they actually underestimate the impact that climate change is having on these extreme events, because you're relying on the ability of the models to capture all of the processes in the real world that are behind these events. And we know that there's some subtle processes related, for example, to how warming changes the behavior of the jet stream and gives us these really stagnant high and low pressure systems that give us extreme weather. The models aren't capturing that very well, so they're probably underestimating the impact that carbon pollution and warming is having on these events.
looking back, the 1970s, when people were first really starting to take climate change seriously, it was a problem kind of down the road. In the 90s, well, our kids, maybe grandkids, we're in it now, right? We're actually feeling human impact from this stuff.
Yeah, it's not subtle anymore. It's no longer about, you know, polar bears up in the Arctic decades from now. It's about these devastating extreme weather events that we are seeing play out in real time in Wisconsin, back here in Pennsylvania, and around the world. The bad news is that it's gotten bad enough that we can see the impacts playing out in real time. That's sort of, you know, the tip of the iceberg. And it tells you how much worse things can get if we fail to act now, if we fail to reduce carbon emissions and stabilize the temperature of the planet.
Talking to Michael Mann from Penn State University, climate scientist there, author of the book, The New Climate War, looking at the connection between climate change and extreme weather events. Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I've been gardening for over 40 years, and I think that anyone that farms or is in touch with their environment would notice the changes. We've had more erratic frost dates early and late, and the autumn, the spring and the autumn seems to have the climate in those areas that seems to change. I think the rainfalls, you know, we used to have like rainy days. That's really rare these days to have like a rainy day, or we have someone will get like 6 inches of rain, you know, 10 miles from here, and we didn't get anything. I mean, there's all sorts of events that are happening, like
I got you, Willem. We're getting some background noise there, but point taken, Michael. Can you talk about the impact on agriculture, whether it's somebody gardening at home like Willem or, you know, a drought in some of the biggest vegetable and fruit producing areas of the country in California?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I actually have some colleagues who are at the University of Wisconsin-Madison who actually specialize in looking at the impact of climate change, for example, on farming and agriculture in the state of Wisconsin. And there's a whole outreach component where scientists actually work with, you know, farmers and ranchers who are dealing with these impacts. And it's sort of interesting because these folks tend to be sort of politically conservative. They tend to be among the groups least likely to actually, you know, accept the science of climate change. And yet they know that something is happening. That's what you hear from these stories. In Wisconsin, here in Pennsylvania, where I have colleagues who sort of do the same sort of outreach and extension to farmers and here in the state of Pennsylvania. You know, it's these people are directly in touch with their environment. Their livelihood depends on their ability to cope with the environment, with, you know, the weather, with these environmental changes. And so they're very sensitive to the changes that are impacting them. And, you know, they see it happening. And so it's absolutely the case that some of the, you know, most interesting evidence of how climate change is impacting us now actually comes from these sorts of folks, farmers and ranchers in Texas, for example, where they lost 25% of their cattle during the unprecedented 2010 drought in Texas and Oklahoma. I mean, they're seeing these impacts. It's impacting their livelihood. And that's actually sort of changing public opinion a little bit. You're seeing some of these, again, people from sort of a demographics that aren't necessarily sort of, you know, the most concerned generally about climate change. They're being forced to become concerned about it because it's impacting them.
People might hear the news that climate change is here now, it's affecting us, and think, well, all right, it's too late, so we can't do anything about it. Do our decisions now make a difference in the years to come?
Yeah, and that's really important because there is this growing sort of sense of doomism. You know, people who aren't climate change deniers, and they're just the opposite. They're extremely concerned. But in fact, they're so concerned that they have sort of fallen into this pit of despair where they're convinced that we can't do anything about the problem anymore. Ironically, that potentially leads them down the same path of disengagement and inaction as outright denial of the problem. So it's really important that, you know, when we friends and family members and colleagues who we see sort of falling into this sort of climate doomism, to make sure they understand that we can actually prevent things from getting worse. And the science actually, you know, supports that pretty strongly. The science, you know, tells us that, you know, if we stop carbon pollution into the atmosphere, the temperature of the planet stabilizes pretty quickly. And so there's a direct and immediate impact of our effort to reduce carbon emissions. If we act now, we can prevent the planet from crossing the threshold of 1.5 Celsius, 3 degrees Fahrenheit, where we'll start to see the worst impacts. But there's urgency as well. There's agency. We can make a difference, but there is urgency. We have to bring those carbon emissions down by about 50% within the next decade if we are to keep warming below that dangerous level.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That's Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State University. We talked with him about the connection between climate change and extreme weather events. Up next, we'll get advice from the state's Emergency Management Department on preparing for extreme weather. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you faced any storm damage yet this year? Are you seeing changes? Do you have questions for the state's Emergency Management Department about how to prepare for extreme weather? Are there things you've done to protect your home, your family, your business, your farm from different kinds of weather changes? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about severe weather. Wisconsin averages 23 tornadoes a year. Last year, more than 40 touched down. Our next guest tells us how to prepare for various kinds of severe weather. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you and your family have a storm preparedness plan? What does that look like? Have you put it into action this year? Do you have questions for our guest about how to prepare for different kinds of weather and natural disasters? Have you been through a big one in your community? What happened in the aftermath? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Beckett is a public information officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. He also runs the state's Ready Wisconsin campaign, which encourages the public to be prepared for emergencies and disasters. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into particular kinds of extreme weather events, are there some general rules you'd suggest to people to prepare for different manners of disaster?
Well, the first thing that we really encourage everyone is to be weather aware. And really what that means is making sure that you have multiple ways to receive information about what the weather is going to be for that day, but as also when severe weather alerts are issued for your area. That includes local media, NOAA weather radios, and having wireless emergency alerts enabled on your smartphone if you have one.
Let's start with heat waves. They can be, they're one of the most lethal kinds of weather-related disasters in the country, but they're not as dramatic. I think people don't necessarily pay attention to them as much. What kind of things do you want to make sure people are paying attention to?
Well, first and foremost, it's knowing the signs that your body's telling you that you're getting too hot. Being able to identify things like heat stroke or heat exhaustion, you know, that cold, clammy skin, or feeling overheated itself, feeling weak, nauseous, dizzy. Those kinds of things are a sign that, you know, you need to get to a cooler area and maybe even seek medical attention if you're really feeling the ill effects, and learning how to spot those signs in others as well. I mean, those are really the critical parts to protecting yourself during the hottest weather, in addition to making sure you're doing things like being hydrated, seeking shady areas, and trying not to be outdoors in direct sunlight during the hottest parts of the day.
I remember from the big Chicago heat wave, was that back in the 90s? The advice really came out after that: check in on vulnerable people, seniors and others, especially if you know they don't have AC. Can you talk about the importance of being in touch with each other during an event like that?
Really, a communications plan is essential when it comes to any sorts of severe weather. You want to make sure that you have that list of contacts for individuals that you can seek help from in the event that you need it, but also to check in on them when a storm moves through the area or a heat event, making sure that you're checking in, especially on elderly neighbors or those who have, you know, disabilities or difficulty getting around on their own and may not have access to something that could be crucial in those kinds of conditions. Making sure you're checking in on them regularly, and if they need assistance, finding a way to get them that help.
Then, of course, tornadoes. I mean, I've lived my whole life in the Midwest, so I feel like most of us know what we need to know. But remind us what we do in cases of tornado watches, tornado warnings.
A watch is when the conditions are right for those tornadoes to develop. And really, that's just a sign that you need to be aware of that potential. But when that warning is issued for your area, you know, that is an indication that there is a threat directly affecting you and that you need to take action. And really, that first thing is, you know, get to a sturdy shelter, whether that be a basement or a ground floor interior room of a built home. You know, those are the areas that you should really be going to seek shelter. The main goal is to put as much distance between you and the outside as possible, because really it's that flying debris that's often kicked up by those strong winds that poses the greatest risk to people.
And then I saw earlier this week was an awareness day for lightning safety. People don't think about it. Again, we're in the Midwest. This is a risk.
Absolutely. You know, lightning can strike miles away from a storm itself. And it's really important to pay attention. If you see that lightning or hear thunder, you know, it's a sign that you could be at risk and that you need to seek shelter indoors, you know, away from trees. Really, there's not any safe place outside. Even a shelter at a park is not a safe place to be from lightning. You really want to get into an enclosed space in order to protect yourself.
And finally, flooding. We've already had some tragic deaths related to flooding in the state this year. A couple key pointers.
Really, the first and foremost thing is stay out of floodwaters. You know, don't drive through them. Don't walk through them. It really only takes a few inches of moving water to knock a person over and potentially carry them away. You know, less than a foot of water can carry most small vehicles away. So it's important to just stay out of the water when you encounter it during a flooding situation. You don't know what the surface of the road is going to look like beneath the surface of that water. And a road that you drove across 20 minutes ago may have crumbled beneath, and you could easily find yourself in a dangerous situation quickly.
Talking to Andrew Beckett with Wisconsin Emergency Management, looking at extreme weather events, how to be ready for them. Now, bigger picture, Andrew, when a tornado, say, hits a community or a major flood, can you talk about the reaction to that disaster, the first steps?
Well, really, the first steps is to make sure that everybody's okay and that they've gotten out safely and are not in immediate danger or have any serious injuries. Afterwards, you know, you want to make sure that you are documenting any damage that was done to your home, contacting local authorities if there is a risk on your property, you know, a tree that's hanging down and might potentially injure somebody if it falls, or utility lines that might be down. You don't want to approach them, but you want to make sure you contact your utility provider with that information so that they can get out there and address the problem as quickly as possible. And, you know, you want to make sure that you are identifying what you need to do in order to help get your life back on track, whether that's contacting your insurance provider, finding out what they need in order to help try and help repair that damage. You know, those are the steps that are really important in the immediate aftermath so that you can work on your recovery as quick as possible.
And you mentioned the insurance company, and I know in disasters around the country, sometimes people are surprised at the wrong moment about what insurance does and doesn't cover when it comes to disasters. What kind of things should people be thinking about, you know, before that disaster strikes?
It's important to make sure you know what your policy covers and then identify what needs to be done with that policy in order to make sure that you have coverage for those things that you may not have thought about. You know, most private homeowners insurance policies do not cover flooding. You either need to purchase flood insurance or maybe even get a rider on your existing policy in order to address any issues that you might see as a result of floodwaters. You know, those are the kind of things that's important to find out about in advance, because it does take time for insurance coverage to take effect. So really talk to your insurance agent, identify what your policy does and does not cover, and identify how you can go about getting your policy expanded potentially if you feel it's needed.
Now, what does it mean when a governor of Wisconsin declares a state of emergency following some kind of natural disaster?
Well, a state of emergency is really a move that is intended to help mobilize state resources if they're requested, whether that be, you know, assistance with debris removal, potentially bringing in the National Guard for assistance. I mean, really, that is a step taken in order to help get the process moving for the deployment of resources quickly if they're requested.
What kind of resources, Andrew, do you point people toward to be ready for natural disasters in the state?
Well, our website, the Ready Wisconsin website, readywisconsin.wi.gov, has a wealth of information on there for the different kinds of threats that exist in the state, but also the things that people can do in order to make their own home emergency kit and make that plan for what to do when they're faced with different types of disasters.
What should be in our home emergency kit?
Home emergency kit should include a basic 72-hour supply of food and water, because it may take time for assistance to get there. Things like battery-operated flashlights, a hand-crank weather radio is a great idea. And then in first aid supplies and other essentials that you might need in the immediate aftermath of an incident.
And do you recommend people kind of review their kits? I know with flashlights in particular, they don't last forever.
Absolutely. Every year is really a good idea to kind of go through those kits and check those expiration dates. Batteries, even non-perishable food sometimes does have a bit of a shelf life, and you may want to consider replacing canned goods every few years. You know, those are the kind of things that should be checked regularly, especially when it comes to things like first aid kits. You don't want to have old medications or even antibiotic or first aid supplies that have gone past their expiration date for when you really need them.
Andrew, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Andrew Beckett is a public information officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. He joined us today to talk about what happens after a natural disaster strikes and how you can prepare for storms and other extreme weather events this summer. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with great Mexican recipes that sample the wide range of cooking styles from all over Mexico. We'll meet the author of Mi Cocina. You can get started right now with a few recipes online at WPR.org/Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, many Muslim Americans experience racism and Islamophobia, especially in the post-9/11 United States. It can be tough to grapple with a sense of identity and belonging in a country that isn't always welcoming. Our next guest shares his story of the challenges and absurdities, the positive moments, and the funny moments, too. Wajahat Ali was born and grew up in California, the child of Pakistani-American immigrant parents. He tries to use humor to cope with discrimination and to tell the story of his experience finding himself in the United States. And he says alongside the challenges, he feels a lot of hope. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or your family had experiences with Islamophobia or racism? What was it like? How do you see Muslim Americans treated in your neck of the woods? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Wajahat Ali is a playwright, a columnist for The Daily Beast, co-host of the Democracy-ish podcast, and author of the new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. Wajahat, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You've got no shortage of stories to tell in your life story, from awkward childhood moments to near-death experiences and more. What led you to want to put it all down in memoir-ish form?
Yeah, memoir-ish. I like that. The story, Go Back to Where You Came From, is about loving a country that doesn't always love you back. And I consider it an elegy for the rest of us, who oftentimes are seen as the co-protagonists, sidekicks, villains, or we're completely erased from the story and just treated as footnotes. And I thought, in this moment in time, there might be an opening, Rob, where fellow Americans might realize, these people of color, these immigrants, these marginalized folks, they're not lying about this thing called white supremacy and racism. They might be onto something. And all their warnings about our democracy being under attack and the fact that we might not have a multiracial democracy, there might be something here to it. So I thought this was a critical time where I could tell this story, my story, but connect it to the story of America right now, undergoing many atrocities and horrors as we are simultaneously doing this push and pull between nativist trends that have existed and the trend to push and expand this country to accommodate all of our children as its potential co-protagonists. So I thought the time was now.
Your parents laid out three career options for you, as I understand it. Doctor, engineer, or successful businessman. Not just businessman, successful businessman. How did you develop your superpower as a writer and storyteller?
Well, yeah, the fourth option is failure. So you forgot failure.
I forgot failure. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's what I call the immigrant checklist of success. It's not just South Asian parents, but it's basically, hey, we came to this country. We left behind everything. We didn't leave behind everything for you to become an English major. And, you know, we want stability and security for you. And we want the dreams that you can't have. So you have to be a doctor or an engineer or a dubious businessman or a businesswoman who somehow makes a lot of money and he marries well and has 2.1 kids and gets a nice house and gets either a Toyota Acura or a BMW. And, you know, my parents, being Pakistani immigrant parents, they're very traditional. We always joke that they brought the boat inside the home. Like, they didn't burn the boat. They brought the boat inside the home. First of all, they named me Wajahat, obviously to blend. They didn't teach me English growing up because who needs English in the Bay Area, California, right? Eh. And they said, eh, you'll learn. But they were very supportive of my artistic talents. So I wrote a story at the age of 10. I mentioned this in the book. And a one-page short story became a 10-page short story. And being the shy, awkward, brown, sweaty kid who wore husky pants, who used to get bullied by his classmates, my teacher said, get up and read this story. And I'm like, please don't make me do it. She goes, get up and do it. And for the first time ever, they were rapt with attention. They didn't mock me. They laughed at all the right parts and they applauded. And that's when I kind of discovered I might have a superhero talent. I might be able to tell a story. And I took that story home to my father, who was drinking chai. He says, beta, which means son, you might have a talent here. You might think about becoming a writer. And my mom ran from the kitchen and said, first become a doctor, which is just insurance, right? My mom was like, just have insurance. But I was very lucky, Rob, that my parents were very untraditional in that they always supported and nurtured the talent. And many children of immigrants don't have that support or the encouragement, and which is why they become doctors and engineers, but secretly very unhappy.
A running theme through the book is, you know, you have a lot of identities, awkward kid, writer, later father. I could go on with that list for a long time. When seen from the outside, especially I think after September 11th, other people, mainly white people, looked at you and saw what?
Osama, Saddam, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, suspect, other, terrorist, potential terrorist, helper of terrorists, potential radical terrorist who might not be a terrorist. Oh, look, a smiling terrorist. It's very interesting that all of us have complex identities, but oftentimes people are of color are the only ones who are hyphenated or have the asterisks, right? And in 9/11, as I mentioned in the book, for many of us, especially those immigrants, children of immigrants, people of color who grew up as the model minority stereotype, a stereotype I hope to demolish in the book, you know, we thought we were American, born and raised in this country, right? Yeah, sure, we don't see ourselves on the billboards or on the cover of the magazines, but we are American. We identify. But overnight, after 9/11, all of a sudden, we became us and them, you know, a terrorist or a suspect. And overnight, from that moment on, me, Wajahat Ali, a Muslim brown kid from California, had to represent and defend 1,400 years of Islamic civilization and 1.8 billion Muslims. And no matter what I did, as Toni Morrison said, that's the exhaustion of racism. It's never enough. You always have to prove your worth, and it's never enough because this nameless judge, jury, and executioner always holds your loyalty, moderation, and patriotism as suspect.
We're talking to Wajahat Ali, author of the new book, Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. Can join in with your questions if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you've experienced some of what Wajahat was just talking about, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. The title, Go Back to Where You Came From, you write right off the bat, this is something you've heard, been emailed, you're active on social media, you've certainly encountered in there. What do you do with that when somebody, especially in person, when somebody says that to you? I don't know what I would do.
Yeah, you know what's so interesting is the title of the book is like a gut punch, right? And the book begins with emails that I receive every day. And I just copy paste the emails. And the first email is, go back to where you came from. I get it almost every day in some aspect, some form. And it's interesting is that for me, I'm so used to it and people of color are so used to it. But there are many readers in the past month, such as yourself, like, oh my God, this happens to you every day? Wow, how would I respond? Oh, ugh. And it just shows you how it is for the rest of us who, even though we're born and raised in this country, are told to go back. So it's how you respond. And so how I respond in the book is like Bugs Bunny. You know, Bugs Bunny is chased by Elmer Fudd and Yosemite Sam, but he uses their own traps against them and sometimes kisses them on the cheek. And at the end, he gets the last laugh, the last word, and he gets the carrot. And so I respond by saying, would you like me to go back to the Bay Area? I'd love to if you could subsidize the rent. Or, oh, are we all going back to the womb? Okay, Freud. Or do you want me to go back to pre-partition India? Because my parents, even my mother wasn't born in India. She was born in Pakistan. And that type of response with some humor is a response, but also kind of dismantles the stupidity and the bigotry of that comment, right? Where apparently the rest of us are here as conditional citizens, and our citizenship and our home loan application and our mortgage can be revoked at any second based upon our ethnicity. And the real American, Rob, apparently the one who was from here, is the white American who, by the way, wasn't from here. It actually belonged to the indigenous Americans, the Native Americans. So it's an ugly sentiment that has been told even to white Americans who weren't once considered white. And if you know your history, I'm talking about Italians, the Irish Catholic, Eastern European Jews, and the Germans. We were all told at one point to go back to where we came from.
Right. But I wonder how you think that, if that's going to change over generations. Like, my family goes back to Poland and Ireland, some other places. You wouldn't know that unless I told you or you did my family, my genealogy or whatever. I just read as white now. You are, you know, second generation, your kids, third generation. Do you worry that because of the skin color difference, that's never going to go away?
Yeah, that's a question I address in the book. You know, that's the test of America. Whether or not America will succeed as a multiracial democracy will be whether or not people like me are considered American or my children are considered American. I'll give you an example. Who's been here since the founding? Black folks. Are they still considered American? Nope, still hyphenated. Latinos? Nope, still hyphenated. Mexicans, indigenous Americans, right? With you and your family, you mentioned Polish and Irish, double whammy, both hated back in the day, but you were able to be absorbed into what I call in the book whiteness. And I'm not talking about white people. With whiteness, it's this paradigm, this structure, this ideology that says those who are considered white or labeled white, which is a social construct, are elevated above all others and are seen as the true inheritors of this country called America, right? Where they have the manifest destiny to come birth this country from savagery and bring forth civilizations. But you are able to be absorbed into whiteness because you look, quote unquote, white. Again, a social construct. Even though you weren't considered white like 100 years ago. Irish were not considered white. But how about the rest of us who don't look, quote unquote, white, even though we've been here even longer? That's the test, right? That's the test, because black folks, people of color, will never be absorbed into whiteness ever. So will we dismantle this ideology of supremacy and have true equality, or will we double down and fight for it and burn the country down? That's the test for the next 20 years.
We're talking to Wajahat Ali about his new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with writer and author Wajahat Ali about his new memoir, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. Wajahat, you think a lot about the portrayal of Pakistani Americans, Muslim Americans in pop culture. I want to take you to a moment. You were younger. Your first kind of breakthrough as a writer was this play you wrote about a Pakistani American family. You're in talks to maybe bring it to LA, and an agent says, hey, maybe as the Pakistani American dad, what do you think of Ted Danson?
Yeah. And I laughed, and there was no other laughter on the other end. And I'm like, wait, you're serious? And he said, yeah, Americans like Ted Danson. I'm like, who doesn't like Ted Danson? I love Ted Danson. I love Cheers. I also like Becker. I also saw him in Gulliver's Travels. But this is a story about a Pakistani-American family, and the father, Salman, is a middle-aged Pakistani man who goes, well, think about Ted Danson. And this was, you know, the play, The Domestic Crusaders, I started writing as a senior at UC Berkeley after 9/11 upon the suggestion and recommendation of my teacher, Ishmael Reed, who's a MacArthur Genius winner. And he, as a black man, said, listen, we've been fighting back for 400 years. Art and culture is how we fight back and tell our stories. Your people, I'm looking at the news right now after 9/11, your people are going to get hazed for 10 years. He was wrong. It's been 20 years. But he said, I've never seen an American story, a kitchen drama story, told from a perspective of, you know, like Muslims or Pakistanis. Write a story like that. And so that story, I had to do it myself, Rob, because I was told 20 years ago, the mainstream will never accept an ethnic story. Translation, white people will not accept a story of brown and Muslim folks. Take away all the ethnic stereotypes and take away all the ethnic mirch and the masala and make it easy and palatable. I proved them wrong. We did it ourselves. And I just want to flex for a moment. This play that was rejected and mocked and ridiculed 6 months ago, 20th anniversary of 9/11, it was republished by McSweeney's with a foreword by Hasan Minhaj and a new conversation between me and Ishmael Reed and Carla Blank. And the play is being taught in schools. The play has been performed around the world. The play is being sold. And so sometimes you just have to do it yourself, have faith in your story, and have faith that the mainstream will come along.
Let's bring on a caller now. Stephanie is with us in Milwaukee. Stephanie, hi.
Hi. I had a comment and also a question. I'm really interested in this topic. I'm a psychology graduate student, and I'm really interested in intersectionality and cultural humility and working with clients. And then just from my experience, I think that it's really helpful to talk about these things, but there are some kind of things that make it difficult for people to talk about it. So my question is, how are some like maybe general ways that can be really good to talk about these things with people, but also with children, because I work with a lot of children, to just talk about this like in a more open way so that we can talk about our different backgrounds, but also talk about difficult kind of topics and how we can talk in a more like inclusive way, including everyone in this conversations that are very important. Thank you.
Stephanie, thanks. A couple big questions there, Wajahat.
Yeah, look, I have three kids. My kids are age 7, 5, and 2, and my wife and I have this conversation all the time, is because you simultaneously want to infuse in them the sense of pride in their culture and their skin color and their tone, especially which is under assault right now in America and their religion. But at the same time, you don't want them to be chauvinists also, right? Or restrictive or reactionary. And we live in a diverse community in Virginia. And so their classmates are different skin tones and different ethnicities and national origins. So what we say is, listen, this is who we are. You know, you're Pakistani American. This is your name. You're Muslim. But listen, at the same time, we live in a country where there's different people, there's different setups, there's different families. And as such, be respectful to everyone. And so what we do is we have had faith in them and their intelligence. So we talk to them. We talk to them at their level. We explain it to them. They're very curious. They understand. I'll give you an example. Even during the pandemic, we explained to them, this is why we're doing lockdown. This is why we're doing virtual school. There's a pandemic. This is COVID. This is why we wear masks. This is why we wash our hands. My children, ages 7, 5, and 2, Rob, wear masks, social distance, right? Clean their hands and understand the reason why they're doing it is to protect themselves and other folks. So even when it comes to topics about racism and culture and diversity and colorism, which we have to deal with if you're brown and black, because light skin tone is still the preferred skin tone. And my poor 5-year-old daughter, a couple of months ago, I wrote a New York Times article about this. She looked in the mirror and she said, oh, I wish I was light skin tone. That's beautiful. And I was like, no, everything we've done for 5 years is failure. And so we just doubled down and instead, you know, reaffirmed her beauty, her brownness, her brown skin tone, and said there's different colors there. But, you know, you are brown and you're beautiful, just like someone who's white or black is beautiful, but this is who you are. So when you're a brown and black person in this country, you are forced to have these uncomfortable conversations about racism, right, and colorism. And I'll just say that really quickly, because oftentimes we're having this conversation, and, oh my God, our children, they can't tolerate these conversations. We have to protect them. I'm like, I was confronted with this at the age of 5 when I was dropped off at preschool and someone said, your skin color is the color of poo. Kids are dealing with this stuff, and it's up to us as parents to actually engage them and give them the right language and the right type of empathy and kindness, and also have faith in them that, listen, you know, this is the world we live in, and these are some of the values that we have, and you can be proud of who you are, but you also have to live in a community of diversity and understand that other folks have different lifestyles as well. And so that's how we've tried to model it. We just go straight in. We talk to them, we treat them with intelligence and sensitivity, and they get it. The kids get it.
Thanks for that call, Stephanie. We're talking to Wajahat Ali. His new book is Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. Wajahat, I hope you don't mind if I spoiled the ending a little bit. You come out with a full endorsement of the power of hope. And as a dad, the story you tell to back that up really hit me. Can you share the story of your daughter and how people came together to give you this hope?
Yeah, the last chapter of the book is called Invest in Hope, but Tie Your Camel First, which is based on this beautiful saying in Islam, this, yeah, have faith in God, but tie your camel first, which means do everything within your power to fix your situation. And after you've done that, you know, there's nothing else you can do except have faith. And, you know, having hope is very dangerous oftentimes in hopeless times, because it means exposing yourself to the possibility that when the page turns, it brings a better story. But oftentimes we're met with what? Pain, disappointment, betrayal, regret. And so it's easier to curl up and have your shields go up and be defensive and cynical and apathetic, right? But like I said in the book, that often requires zero investment and means being a spectator. You know, being in the ring of life means exposing yourself to pain. And that was really brought to the forefront with my daughter's diagnosis 3 years ago, where she was diagnosed 8 months before the pandemic with stage 4 liver cancer, all over the liver with a cancer speck in her lungs. And we're like, we didn't know she'd survive. And we needed a full liver transplant, and time was running out. And with the power of storytelling, I shared Nuseiba's story, and over 500 people, mostly strangers, stepped up to potentially be a liver donor for a girl they had never met, including people who told me they hated my politics, but they wanted to save a little girl. And finally, this one anonymous donor who later revealed himself to be Sean Zaheer, who coincidentally lived close by, decided, oh, let me go give a piece of my liver to this little girl. And this little girl survived because a community came together to rally around a little girl who had stage 4 cancer. You know, we raised the funds, raised the word, got an anonymous donor, Sean Zaheer, and now Nuseiba is in the next room, dressed up in one of her many costume changes of the day, Rob. You know, cancer-free, healthy, living her best life, and you know, she's still immunosuppressed during a pandemic, but you know, throughout that journey, I imagined what would happen if she passed away, if she prepared myself as a parent, right? Mm-hmm. So I imagined it and I steeled myself with these possibilities. But there was also another narrative where she lived. And she lived to be happy and healthy and married and have kids. And I chose to invest in that story.
Do I remember this right? Sean Zaheer, the person who had donated a chunk of liver to your daughter, his question on waking up is, Doc, when can I donate blood next time?
Yeah. Just that was his first question. And the doctor who operated on him, he started crying. He said, listen, I've done this a lot of times. That's the first time I've ever had a donor wake up and ask that question. Usually it's like, when can I get back to work? Am I safe? Am I healthy? But he said, hey, when can I give blood again? Because he's also a marrow and blood donor. And then he told me, he says, you have a good man's liver in your daughter. You have a good man's liver in your daughter. You're very lucky.
And just our last minute, Wajahat, how can we follow his example? I don't know. How can we pick that path of hope and generosity over all the other stuff we know is out there?
In the final minute, I will say this. I often get told, I'm nobody, Waj. And I'm like, some of my favorite people are nobody. I'm a nobody also. I think everyone has a superhero talent. Everyone has something. And the way you behave, the way you model yourself every day in your life, at home, at school, at work, can be a reflection of how you want this country to be. Run for school board. Run for city council, you know, go out to a church, do interfaith, give money to the right candidates. In your behavior, in your language, change it up to be more empathetic, more sensitive, and try to model this behavior for your children. Think about how that will impact future generations. At the end of the day, we could only control our own actions and our own intentions. And if we model that behavior, then you know what? That's the best way to go out.
Wajahat, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me.
Wajahat Ali is a columnist for The Daily Beast. He's a playwright. He was with us sharing his new book. It's called Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. That was an archive conversation. Our scheduled Food Friday guest, ironically, after our storm conversation, his power was knocked out by a storm down in Texas or Mexico. I'm not sure where he is. We will hopefully reschedule that conversation about Mexican cooking coming up on a future Food Friday. Coming up after the news, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade today and the federal protection for abortion. We'll talk to a court expert about what went into that ruling, what it means for access in states around the country where these decisions now go. We want to hear from you. What questions or concerns do you have about the future of abortion access and reproductive rights now that Roe v. Wade has been struck down? What does it mean to you to have or not have that choice? What do you want to see happen here in Wisconsin, where as of at least right now, an 1849 law banning all but a few cases of abortion in case of protecting the life of the mother would all be struck down under that law. You can join in that conversation coming up at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Or you can pass your questions, maybe your experiences, along to WPR's Why Sconcin project. Let us know what you want to know, your personal story, if you're willing to share, what you want to hear from us on the radio in the days to come. Your responses will help shape the stories we tell and the questions we ask. You could submit that at whysconcin.org. That's whysconcin.org. And follow the latest news at WPR.org. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Wisconsin Republicans and Democrats set their priorities in their annual state conventions. Find out what issues are front and center in this year's midterm elections. That's coming up Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Some good news this week for our neighbors to the south and fans of bloodhounds. An Illinois bloodhound named Trumpet won the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show. That's the big one in the dog show world here in the U.S. Trumpet is the first ever bloodhound to win Best in Show at the annual event, and it came in his rookie year. Trumpet is 4 years old, but his first ever dog show was just in January. According to the New York Times, he comes from a family of record holders. Trumpet's great-grandfather, named Tigger, once held the Guinness record for the dog with the longest ears, over 13 and a half inches each. Keeping our ears to the news, this is Central Time.